Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing from a female entrepreneur that believes in herself so much that she was willing to quit a job she was unfulfilled at to go after her dream, not once, but twice. First going from being a lawyer to moving into property management. And then after getting an MBA from MIT and landing a sweet six-figure job with a startup tech company, she decides to leave and start her own real estate investment company. This girl makes a decision on where she wants to go in life, and then she makes it happen. Before we jump into the intro, I want to thank all of you. We launched the podcast just a few months ago, and we already have over 250 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. This has been amazing and so much fun. If you are enjoying the podcast, I've got a big ask for you. Can you please send out a share with a link to your favorite episode on your social media? That's right. Actually, share the podcast with all your followers on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, wherever. This is your chance and your opportunity to take action and help others get exposed to the wealth-building impact of real estate. I thank you in advance for what you are about to do. Now, on to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing, be introduced to the players that are getting it done, and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Ellie Perlman before we start the show. Ellie grew up in Israel as the oldest of four children. Her parents told her that she could do anything she wanted to in life, and she believed it. She's a general partner on six properties for 2,000 units. She's a podcast host. She writes financial publications for Forbes, and she is a regular speaker on the multifamily conference circuit. This girl definitely has the abundance mindset. Hello, everyone. So today we have a very special guest with us. We've got Ellie Perlman. Ellie, I appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Fantastic. So the way Ellie and I know each other, actually, we have not spoken before, but I've been in the multifamily space for about 3 years, and Ellie's face just seems to pop up everywhere. So she has made a name for herself. She's got a podcast. She writes for different financial publications. She's a syndicator. She's involved in a lot of the multifamily conferences. She's a speaker. So I'm interested to get to know her better and understand her journey. So with that, Ellie, can you just share high level how many properties you're involved in and how many units?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we own, since I've started Blue Lake Company, Blue Lake Capital, we own about 2,000 units. So give or take about six assets at this point.
Awesome.
And yeah, I mean, our main focus is probably, similar to what you do. We just buy, multifamily properties. That's what I love doing and, what I understand, actually. That's our bread and butter.
Absolutely. So yesterday I was driving back and forth from Dallas to Houston. And, to prepare for this conversation, I happened to listen to a number of your podcast episodes. Mm. And so one thing I wanted to ask you was you have an accent. Where are you from?
I'm from Israel, actually.
Okay, fantastic. So when did you come to the U.S.?
That was March of 2014.
And I believe you were in the corporate world before getting into multifamily as an attorney. Is that correct?
Yeah, I actually started my career as a commercial real estate lawyer, and I thought that that's what I wanted to do. But very quickly, I understood that it's interesting, but I actually wanted to be on the other side of, you know, the table when I was, and I realized that when I was sitting in conference rooms with my real estate, you know, owners that used to be, you know, with my clients, and I said, I told myself, wow, I want to be them. I want to own lands. I want to own properties. I want to, you know, deal with investors and do what they do. But I just didn't know how to do it. And I didn't know, you know, I assumed that I had to have a lot of money to own real estate, which is, you know, of course not true. And after that, I basically said, okay, I want to understand real estate a bit more. So I quit my job and I took a very, interesting job as a property manager, which, you know, was less prestigious than my friends and family thought that I went mad.
Right. I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's funny. Keep going. That's interesting because that takes a lot of courage to actually make the jump like that, you know, and try to learn another industry. And, you know, being an attorney or doctor has a prestige to it.
Yeah.
But you were in the room and you actually saw other people and you're like, I want to be on the other side of the table.
Yes. But you know something, it's also an illusion because I realized that if I don't go to the office, if I don't clock in, if I don't have a certain amount of billable hours, I may not get paid. And I saw my clients and I realized, I mean, they're sleeping, you know, while they're sleeping, they're making money because people are paying rents. They're traveling and they can take, you know, a month off, a week off, whatever it is. And the money is still flowing. So the whole concept of cash flow, it kind of hit me right there that I have to go to the office. I can't just, you know, if I'm sleeping, I'm not making money because I'm not billing clients. And how long can I do that? And, you know, how long do I want to collect dollars, you know, and charge billable hours until when? Until I'm 70, 80? And I realized right. that was not my dream. My dream was to create sustainable cash flow. I didn't know even to put it in a cash flow, you know, phrase. It was not my, that's my lingo today. But back then it was kind of a feeling that I didn't really know how to even put in words, but I knew one thing, and that it was that I wanted to be on the active side of real estate. And for me, it was through, you know, transition into property management. And it was, you know, I got my hands dirty. I learned how to deal with tenants. I learned, you know, a lot of things that actually, you know, are serving me today. And then and all of that was actually in Israel between 2007. Oh, okay. Well, 2007 until 2014.
So you were in property management for 7 years.
No, I mean my entire path from becoming a lawyer until coming to the US was about 7 years.
So how is that split between being an attorney and property management?
In property management, it was probably about 4 to 5 years.
Wow. You've really got to know the business then, you know, being on the property management side for that long. You know, I love what you said. You said, I want to do what they do. I just don't know how. How did you make the transition now? So now you quit your job as an attorney, you're property manager for 4 years, you learn the business. How do you end up getting on the investment side?
Not right away. So, you know, at some point I told myself, you know, I want to move to the US because I believe that this is where I'm going to have, you know, the opportunity to actually grow, you know, but I didn't know how to do it exactly. And the way that I was able to make decent living was through education. I was born to a pretty poor family. And through education, I put myself on a path to, you know, becoming a lawyer and making a decent living. So I just replicated the same way because that's what I knew. And I said, of course, you know, why not shoot for the moons? And that's what I did. And I got into MIT. And I said, you know what? That's a good ticket. That's a good way to enter the US. I'll go to a reputable school. I'll learn. I have actually an MBA. I'll learn more the financials, marketing, you know, kind of the business side, because I had the legal experience and education. I had actual knowledge of how to operate properties.
Right.
But that part of, you know, really reading, interpreting financial reports, building models, running numbers, all of those things, I didn't really have that. And that was the missing, you know, piece for me. And I spent, you know, I spent several years there and got my MBA degree. And really, it was a really interesting, you know, 2 years where I learned a lot about the American culture, about the business culture, and learn how to talk to investors. You know, I was working with a startup while I was going to school, and we raised, you know, $5 million during the summer. That was the first time that I understood, how money flows. And I actually understood that there's money out there. There's no shortage of money. You just need to present to investors the right opportunity and back it up with numbers and a very clear vision of how they're going to make money. And I implemented that, you know, and after I graduated, basically, you know, I started Bullet Capital, and that's what I do today. You know, I bring investors to deals with me and I show them the path of how they're going to make money.
Fantastic. So you come to 2014, you go to MIT, you're there for 2 years. You graduate 2016, and then you start Blue Lake in 2016?
2017. It wasn't right away.
Mm-hmm. So 2017. Well, you've got a fantastic foundation, okay? But how do you, you start the company, but how do you get your first deal? How do you put yourself out there? Getting the first deal can be the biggest challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear that question a lot from aspiring syndicators who want to get the first deal. It's kind of the chicken and the egg. You want to have the first deal, but investors are not going to invest with you if you don't have experience. Brokers are not going to want to work with you and, you know, bet on you if you've never closed the deal before. But how are you going to do it if nobody's going to give you a chance to, you know, to do to your first deal? So I think, for me, it was a lot about, you know, I tried whatever I could, and I dedicated, again, I quit I was working for for a tech company. I quit my job and I focused only on building Blue Lake. And again, people thought I went mad because I was making, you know, nice, very easy 9 to 10 to 4. I had a very laid back job, made 6 figures. It was the easiest money I've ever had and the most boring thing I've ever done because right. I felt that I had so much more, you know, potential, and I felt that I was using 10% of my brains and my capabilities. And I think when you don't have money, all you can think of is make money, because I didn't have enough even to buy food at some point. But when you make money, it stops being about money, and you have, you know, the capacity to think, okay, what do I really want? Am I fulfilled or am I not fulfilled? And money is secondary once you get it.
I would agree with that. And I would say that, you know, you probably had the same experience. There's probably 85-90% of the people that feel the way you felt. But the difference is when they make that money, they end up buying the nicer car, the nicer house, and then they're a slave to the debt that they've taken mm-hmm. on. And so for one reason or another, I mean, one, you had the courage to quit and put your focus towards this. And secondly, you must have put some money aside and lived below your means to give mm-hmm. you kind of the running room to do that.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, to your question, you asked me, how did I do the first deal? I actually partnered with someone that was more experienced. And I think that is the best way to enter multifamily and to become a syndicator. So I actually took I think it was all the money that I had left at that point, and I paid a mentor. I was looking for a mentor. I interviewed several of them, and I went with the person that I thought, you know, had achieved what I wanted to achieve in a relatively short period of time. And so I paid for a mentor, and then I partnered with someone that was more experienced than me. And that way I solved the chicken and the egg problem, because I found a way to add value to their deal. And when I brought investors to the deal, my lack of experience was irrelevant. Well, first of all, I had a legal, you know, background in real estate. I was a property manager. So I had some relevant experience, but not direct experience. But my lack of experience in managing and, you know, owning and managing multifamily was irrelevant, because my partner had a lot of experience, my JV partner. So it made it not, it wasn't even an issue, because, you know, investors invest with people they like and trust. So if they liked me, they trusted me, but they also trusted my JV partner's, you know, experience. And that was my way of getting the first deal. I wasn't paid that much. You know, I wasn't controlling the deal, but in order to grow as a businessman or a businesswoman, I've learned pretty early on that you got to neutralize, you know, your ego. My ego was a little bit bruised because, you know, I wanted to have the first deal and run it on my own. Sure. That was my vision, my passion to run a company, but this is not how you start. I could have done it on, you know, on a deal and take a lot of risk and put investors' money at risk, but I put my ego aside and I said, okay, this is not going to be your deal 100%, but it's not his deal 100% either, because you're partner on this deal, and that's okay. And that's how I did it.
I mean, look, listeners, listen up to that. Two things that she said. One is, you know, she hired a mentor, you know, so she hired somebody that had already done it and can teach her how to do it. And then secondly, I would wholeheartedly agree with Ellie that if you want to get into, now it's different if you want to buy a duplex or a fourplex or something like that, but if you want to get into large scale multifamily, I personally believe you will not win a deal if you are not partnered with an experienced syndicator. And the reason being is these deals are so competitive that there's always three or four groups that are pretty close together, and the broker is not going to take a chance on somebody that, you know, they don't have any experience with. So they're going to recommend to the seller to go with the proven buyer. And so, you know, Ellie was smart that she, as she said, she put her ego aside, but, you know, I don't know if I would say it that way. You know, she was smart, you know, because it was a higher percentage opportunity to get into the game by doing that, taking a smaller piece. And so I applaud you for doing that. And now since that time, like I said, you know, I got into it like the last 3 years, and I see you as speaker at almost every major multifamily conference. So how did you go from, hey, I just want to get into my first deal to, you know, being, you know, a leader in the space?
I think it kind of happened at the same time, and it didn't just happen. It was a very carefully planned, you know, path. The first thing that I did was actually hire team members that could help, you know, help me create content, position me as a thought leader. And, you know, I knew a lot about multifamily. I wasn't the smartest person, you know, or the most experienced, but I didn't present myself at the beginning like this. I said, hey, I know a little bit about multifamily. Let me share this knowledge with you. And I found a way to add value to passive investors, basically saying, hey, this is how I underwrite deals. Hey, this is, you know, these are the three things you need to look at when you're, you know, looking at a package that a syndicator sends you, or this is how I raise rents. And just share the information of, you know, things that I've been learning and implementing. And I had a team that, you know, a few people, it's not a huge team, and you can pay them by the hour. You know, if you're on a very tight budget, you can even hire them from abroad, which I have not done, but I know that others are doing it. And it could be $7 to $10 an hour if it's outside of the U.S. I chose to go with the U.S. team because, you know, I had different considerations, but
sure,
you can do that and make sure that your team is putting out content out there. That was one part of it. The second part is I networked. I spent a lot of money on networking, flew to every conference that was targeting, usually conferences, they don't target passive investors. They're so passive. They're not going to pay on a ticket and get on, you know, and get a hotel room for 3 days. There are exceptions. I did meet some passive investors, but a lot of, you know, I met a lot of young syndicators, a lot of students that were in the same program as my former mentor's program. And that's how actually all the people that I've partnered since then, since that first deal, were people that I either met at conferences early on when I was still a student. I met other students, and you basically, you know, you feel you meet someone, you see if you like them, you see, okay, can they bring a deal? Can they bring capital? How can we work together? And then as I grew, as I grew my business, I started meeting people that became my JV partners and actually my friends on stage. When I was speaking on stage and someone else was speaking on stage, then, you know, off stage, you're connecting, you're talking, and that's how you build a business. Others can, you know, find one or two partners and they form a company and they run this way. There are many ways to do it.
Right.
But hiring a team to create a good foundation for online presence and networking with people. A lot of people that I met in conferences were running their own, you know, podcasts or conferences, and they've invited me to be there. So a combination of, you know, putting content online and networking, and, you know, really I was flying every month, I think, to a different conference every 2 months. That's how I, you know, built my brand and started, you know, getting invited to conferences and podcasts. And once you start doing that, it's like a snowball because the industry is not that huge and everyone is looking around to see who's a good speaker, who's an interesting person to be on the show. It's sure. Usually a rotation of the same people.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you said a few things there. I mean, people talk a lot about you got to get out there and network. You got to get out there and network. Yeah. But then some people may hear that and they say, well, what's the value to that? Right. And you answered it. You know, the people that you partnered with are people that you met at these conferences. So you had to invest in yourself. Not only did you invest in yourself by hiring a mentor, but then you continued to invest in yourself by paying to go to these conferences. And then you met these different people, you know, and you started surrounding yourself with like-minded people, some that were, you know, below you. Like when I say below you, I just mean looking to get their first deal and you can help educate them. And then others that have more experience than you and they can teach you. And so that's what's great about this industry. And if you go out there and network and get to know people, people actually want to help each other. And mm-hmm. and that's fantastic. Another thing you said early on was, and I want to get your take on this, you know, you started talking about cash flow and you said my mindset wasn't really that way initially, but now it is. And I have to say, I kind of fall into that same bucket where, you know, I just got into the multifamily space about 3 years ago. I've been in a number of different industries and I've owned my own business. And, but I grew up with the mentality of, you know, work hard, climb the corporate ladder, put some money aside, put it in the stock market and grow your nest egg. And eventually someday you'll retire and then you could pull from that nest egg. But when I started networking and I hired a mentor and I started getting around other people in this business, they talked to me about cash flow. Mm-hmm. And they talked to me and gave me a mindset shift. Hey, Darren, it's not so important in terms of how big that nest egg is. Just look at buying assets that produce cash flow and then have your lifestyle be less than what the cash flow coming in is. And then you don't have to worry about how big that nest egg is. The other thing they said, which I hadn't had somebody say it to me before, but I completely agreed, was like, you spend 30 years building up this nest egg. You don't want to pull it down. Like you don't want to like all of a sudden have it take away from it and then see it going down. So that puts yourself in a position that you're going to live a pretty meager lifestyle because you're not wanting to pull that big nest egg down. So what are your thoughts there?
I think my point of view is a bit different. I think, you know, I had a shift in mindset, from, you know, at first, like many, many people, I had a scarcity mindset. There's an infinite amount of money in this world. I get X and I'm producing, you know, Y, whatever it is. And it's the focus on my expenses at some point was so tiring to me. And I said, I had to shift. And when I did that, and of course it was with the help of books and podcasts and things that I was inspired by, was basically to an abundance mindset, which means, you know, there's enough money out there. There's no shortage of money. Once you say that and you believe in that, it changes you. It changes the way that you behave. Even when you speak with an investor, if you're in the back of your mind, have a scarcity mentality and you think, you know, that I need to get money for this deal and I may or may not be able to raise it. These fears have a tendency to manifest themselves in and become a reality sometimes. But when you're, because investors are going to feel your fear, your concern, and even in a subconscious level, some of them were a bit more tuned to that, would pick it up and would not invest. And when you have that abundance mindset, that, you know, positive mindset that says everything is possible. I wasn't even here 6 years ago. And I was able to build, you know, wealth that I'm not going to say beyond my dreams because I have pretty big dreams, but it was pretty significant. I didn't think I would do it so quickly.
Right.
And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, obviously. And it's still very hard. But, you know, to your question, my focus, the shift was, how do I grow my income and not so much how do I cut my costs? How do I cut my expenses so I have enough, you know, to live in a comfortable way? I never thought of saving for retirement because retirement was so far off and I still never do. I don't have a 401k. I don't believe in 401ks, to be honest with you. There's a reason why most of the wealth is being held by a very small percentage of the population. And those people on the very top, they're not concerned about pensions or 401ks because it's, in my opinion, and some, in, you know, some listeners might not like what I say, but it's kind of a limiting beliefs and limited, you know, thinking. I'm not saving pennies, you know, or, you know, a few dollars and add more and more until I have enough when I retire. I want to live comfortably even before that. And the shift is not, you know, the focus is not, you know, to save some money and protect it so I have enough when I retire, is starting to build wealth when I'm still young. And I think that shift was very helpful for me in building my business.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. And the people that are in this business have that abundance mindset. And that's why they are open to sharing, you know, like they're, you know, why is somebody that has six properties going to help the guy that gets the first? Because they have an abundance mindset. And they're, you know, and look, there's something about being a human on this earth that, yeah, we all want to be successful. And part of that is financial success and financial freedom. And part of that is time freedom. And part of that is just the joy of helping other people. And, you know, you can do that by, you know, charitable donations, et cetera, or getting involved in charities. But you can also do that just by helping other people achieve their goals and dreams. And this industry is fantastic about helping each other. And part of the reason why, I guess, is because one, they have an abundance mindset. And two, there's a lot of partnering that goes on. So, you know, if you, you know, people may, you may not partner with them today, but 3 years down the road, you might. So, so you mentioned fear. Talk about a time you were afraid and how you were able to push past that fear and talk about making the decisions to quit two times. One time you quit being an attorney and you went to become a property manager, and you knew before you did it. I'm sure you didn't say it, but I'm sure you did. You knew that your parents and your friends and family and colleagues were going to judge you based on that decision, but you still did it. So you had to have some fear. Talk about fear and how you pushed past it.
So actually, I was afraid not to do it. I was actually afraid to stay in an unfulfilling place. And I guess, I don't know why, but that was my real fear. You know, fast forward when I'm 50 years old and I'm still sitting here and not achieving my dreams and my goals, I think that was scarier than actually quitting. Because once you have, and that's why I'm a huge believer in education, once I have, you know, I was a lawyer, I had that diploma, I passed the bar. If I fail by taking another route, I can always get a job. Same, you know, when I, you know, after MIT, I was working a very cushy job. If Blue Lake is not going to work, I can always go back. You know, nobody's going to take the 3 degrees that I've, you know, collected. And it's always something I can fall back to. And that brings me a lot of comfort, and that neutralizes the fear. And I think then another part of it is, what's the worst that can happen? Really, what's the worst that can happen? It's not like, if you try and break it down to why, and it was scary. It was scary to quit my job and start this. It took me time. I didn't just do it. There was a time that elapsed where I was, you know, getting ready to make that move, and I could financially afford it at least a second time. And it was still very uncomfortable. It was still a little scary, but you get to a point where you're ready when you're thinking about it and you're analyzing it, and you say, you know what? It's much scarier to stay in an unfulfilled, you know, position. I want to do this. You just need to let some time, you know, pass.
I applaud you. Well, you know, I think that people that do it, you know, they can lean back on prior times that they felt that uncomfortable feeling and they took mm-hmm. action anyway, mm-hmm. even though they worked. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps the next time you're uncomfortable to go and push past that. But, you know, you said something that I've had a lot of people say the same thing on other very successful syndicators, that they think, what's the worst thing that could happen?
Yeah.
You know, what's the worst thing that can happen? And then what's the best thing that can happen? Mm-hmm. And typically when they look at it that way, they're like, you know what? I could live with the worst case scenario, but the best case scenario is so much better. You know, it's worth going after. And I think that there's a lot of people in this world, because you could always find a reason not to do something. Right? Find a reason not to take action, not to leave your job, right? To stay where you're at, not to move, not to start your own business, not to get into an investment. There's always reasons. And, you know, I interviewed somebody 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he's like, you know, when I first started investing, I had people tell me, you're crazy, it's the top of the market. Da, da, da. He's like, those same people, you know, 10, 15 years later, still have not invested.
But you know what? That's exactly it. When people give you advice, look at how well they are doing in the same area. If someone never made a fortune by investing in real estate, how can they give you the right advice? They don't know. They've never done it, or they've never done it successfully. Right. It's like if you're having issues with your partner, you're not going to go to a friend of yours that has been divorced 3 times to get advice about, you know, relationships, right? Why are people getting advice from others that are not financially successful? These are exactly the limiting beliefs that led them to where they are today. And there's a reason why they're there. There's a reason why, you know, there's a 1% of the population that holds most of the wealth in the world. I can guarantee you most of them were afraid at some point, and they still did it. Of course, it's not, they took a calculated risk, but they were uncomfortable, and it's good. Fear is sometimes good. We're trained to think that fear is a bad thing, it's supposed to protect us. It's not. It's, of course, I'm not going to jump from, you know, the roof without the right, you know, without a harness and the right equipment. But sometimes acting against your fears, if it's reasonable and you're taking the right precautions, it's a good thing. Fear is actually something that grounds you and tells you, no, be like everyone else. Stay here. This is safe. Don't listen to it. You got to work against fear. And this is how you grow. If you're comfortable, you're never going to grow. All the people around you, you know, look at Sam Zell, very, very successful real estate, entrepreneur and investor.
Probably the top, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a billionaire estate guy. So
and read his, you know, biography. He took risks. He worked super hard.
Absolutely.
But he didn't fall, you know, he didn't let fear, you know, bind him and dictate what he's going to do. And so if you want to learn how to do it, you want to be inspired, pick up books and read about successful real estate, you know, entrepreneurs and developers and investors. And that's what helps me, because when I was reading those books, I said, wait a minute, I can do that. It's actually not that scary.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an awesome mindset. So I would, you know, you talked about fear and moving through it, and that it's actually a good thing. You said that a number of times.
Yeah.
And it made me think that, you know, the times that, you know, I have fear and I push forward anyway is when I feel alive. Mm-hmm. You know, like you feel alive. You feel like you're stretching yourself. You're, you know, just like working out, and you're trying, you know, you're trying to lift heavier weight. You're pushing yourself to do something you haven't done before. And the journey many times to me is so fulfilling. When you get to the actual end goal, yeah, it's nice to have that financial reward and that scorecard, but you know, it's like, okay, what's next? Because that's what the juices get flowing, right?
And exactly right.
So, now your podcast isn't just about multifamily. You bring on people from a number of different asset classes, but you tend to focus on investing in multifamily. So my question to you is twofold. One, why do you choose multifamily over other real estate classes? And secondly, why do you choose to bring on people, you know, outside of that area?
So I bring people from, you know, that are investing not only in multifamily, because I'm a curious person. I always want to learn. And right now I love multifamily. I don't think I'm going to stop buying, but maybe I want to venture out and diversify. I'm also a passive investor. So I like to hear about other, you know, asset classes that I might invest passively. And I think it also opens up, you know, my audience a bit more, because you have people who are flippers and they want to listen to an episode about flipping homes, and then they stick around and they hear about multifamily and they become my investors.
That's a good point.
And also, you know, many times passive investors who are my main audience is, you know, basically passive investors, they don't invest only in multifamily. They also like to invest in self-storage. They like to invest, you know, in student housing sometimes. So they have a little bit from everything. The main focus is multifamily, but you have also some episodes about other, you know, asset classes and strategies. And the reason why I like multifamily, I mean, I think it's pretty simple. You know, I used to be a tenant before, so I understand, you know, the needs and of a tenant and how management is being perceived. And, you know, I used to live in an okay building and I used to live in class A buildings. And I kind of understand how the needs are different from one class, you know, to another. And the increase in demand for multifamily is just overwhelming. You have Gen Z that don't want to buy a house because they like the freedom of getting a job in San Francisco and then 2 years later move to New York. They're delaying the age of marriage and having kids. So they want to have the flexibility. even if they're going to have, if they're going to buy a single family home for investment, they want to have the ability to move. It's not, we're not in the 50s and 60s anymore where you wanted, you know, you're in your, you know, early 20s, you got married, have kids, you have one home where you hope to, you know, stay in until your last day. Things have changed. And you also have another big portion of the U.S. population, which is baby boomers, and they're empty nesters. So many times they move, you know, to a smaller condo, or they're actually renting a place because they want someone to take care of everything. They don't want to handle with the hassle of managing a house, especially a big house that is empty now. So these two, the combinations of Gen Z and baby boomers' needs, in addition to the fact that it's getting harder every year to get mortgage and buy a single family home, even if interest rates are down now, it's much harder to qualify for a mortgage. So a lot of, you know, young couples, young professionals tend to rent until they have enough, you know, net worth to purchase a house. So I just see the demand for multifamily growing, and you make money where, you know, investing in something that has high demand. It's, you know, for me, it's a pretty simple choice, I think.
Now, you brought up a great point, and I don't think that all the syndicators really focus on that, but there really has been a shift, you know, with the population, both on the younger generation and also the older generation, that, you know, the younger generation used to buy homes at an earlier age, and they're delaying that. And the baby boomers, everyone thought they were going to sell the big mansion and then move to Florida and buy another house. And a lot of them are selling the house, but they're moving into apartments. Mm-hmm. And that was a big surprise for a lot of people. But because of that, you have more and more renters. That's more and more competition that, you know, helps put pressure on, you know, increasing the rental prices. So you answered that you said you're very curious and that you like to learn. And that's one thing that I love about this business too, is that, you know, I like building relationships. I like doing deals. But I also like to learn. You know, I like to read books and learn. And one of the other things I love about this business is that there's no limit. There's no ceiling. It's really all what your mind can, you know, believe. And then, you know, going out and building relationships with investors that can help make that happen. You know, so you can start out with, you know, 100 unit or 60 unit, and then do a 200 unit, and then 300 unit, and 500 unit, and then buy a portfolio. And then like you're saying, you could go and start looking at different asset classes, self-storage, mm-hmm. you know, hotels, office, you know, you could build a skyscraper, you know, you could build a shopping complex. There really is no limit, where most industries, you know, say you're a sales guy in a big tech firm, like, you're looking at the guys that are making a killing in the company, right? And there's a big ramp up, and you're trying to chase them and get there. But once they get there, it's really hard for them to continue to blow it out, like, and continue to grow. Like, they start over every year. And so you kind of top out at a certain point. But with real estate, you're kind of just building it on top of each other. You know, you're buying an investment, then you get into a larger investment and you put that on top, and then it's all what your mind can achieve. So, I mean, I think I love that curiosity. I love that you have a lot of courage and confidence that you're going to be successful. And I think a lot of people can learn from that.
Thank you. I mean, don't get me wrong, people doubted me my whole life because my goals were perceived as too ambitious. I was often called too ambitious by people that were very, very close to me. You know, when I was 19 years old, I wanted to become a lawyer. You know, you needed to get a certain score in the Israeli equivalent of SAT. And I got the results in the mail. And I was so nervous to open it. My ex-husband at the time, who's not my husband anymore, held the envelope. And I said, I'm too nervous. I can't look at it. Please tell me what my score is. I want to know if I got into law school. And he looked at it. I remember he was looking at me. I remember where we were standing right outside the post office. And he looked at me again, looked at the envelope, then looked at me and said, "You're never going to become a lawyer."
What?
And that's why he's not my husband anymore. One of many, you know, reasons. But I remember looking at him and grabbing the note, the letter, looking at my score. It wasn't the highest. And I said, "Oh, yes, I will." And then I spent 18 months taking the test again and again, improving my grades. Not only I got in, maybe not with the highest, you know, grade, but I finished with excellence. I think with a 93, you know, average out of 100, because we don't have the ABCD scale in Israel. And then when I said, okay, I wanted, you know, I said, I will become a successful real estate, you know, owner. I don't know how I'm going to own real estate. And people were very, very close to me who actually wanted the best for me, tried to shield me from, you know, from disappointment, said, "You're shooting for too, it's too much, it's too high, you're too ambitious, it's going to hurt you." And I said, "No, just watch me." And then when I wanted to go to MIT, I actually hired a company to help me write, you know, help me understand what to write in the essays, how, you know, help me navigate through the GMAT, et cetera. And they looked at my history, my scores, my, you know, everything else. And they said, "You know what? MIT is a stretch. We don't think you'll make it." And I said, "Just watch me." And so people, yes, they doubted me because they thought that I can't do it. And I don't know if it's courage or just, I just decided that that's what's going to happen. And when you do that, you change your behavior, the decisions you make on the conscious and subconscious level. You might, you know, feel that it's a bit forced at first, that you need to, that you don't really believe what you're saying to yourself, that you're going to make it. But I just decided, and I said, "No, I'm going to get to one of the top schools." I, you know, applied to Harvard. I applied to Stanford. I didn't get into them, but I got into MIT. And I said, "You know what? I'll take it." Not only I got in, I got a scholarship. So, and I remember going back to the guys that helped me and I said, "Hey, just want to let you know, I got in, I got a scholarship." And I said, "What?" They couldn't believe it. And so, yeah, I worked super hard to get in there. I spent about $10,000 or $12,000 to get there because I paid them by the hour, but I got there. And I think just, you know, mindset is everything. It's not just, you know, rah-rah. It's, you know, whatever strategy. It helped change my life.
Good for and you.
It starts from within, just believing yourself.
You defined yourself where, yeah, you know, so many people are going to let other people define who they are, you know, and what they can be.
Yeah.
And you stood up for yourself and you defined yourself. And that's awesome. So I applaud your new husband. I haven't met him, but
he's great. You know,
but yeah, I'm sure that he encourages you to go after that next dream. And he's not somebody trying to put you down and keep you in place.
100%.
What a inspiration to so many people. And, you know, I think that, you know, men and women both have the same opportunity. But I feel like men go after, you know, financial success more, and it's nice to have women as examples of, you know what, I want to do this, I'm going to make it happen. And then you're an example, a shining example to other people. I have a senior in high school, my daughter, my son's a sophomore in college, but my daughter is senior in high school. Like, I want her to know people like you that, you know, stand up for themselves and believe in themselves so much that even if they hear you can't do that, it doesn't stop them, you know? So I talk in terms to my kids, you know, do you have thin skin or thick skin? Like, you need to have thick skin because no matter what you want to do, there's going to be people to tell you no, and you have to be able to brush it off and move on, you know? So that's an awesome story. Awesome, awesome, awesome.
Thank you, Darren.
Talk to me about how you grew up. So you grew up in Israel. Are you an only child? Do you have, you know, brothers and sisters? Where did you fit in? You mentioned that you didn't grow up wealthy. You grew up more on the poor side. So give us a little flavor on how you grew up.
So I grew up, I'm the oldest of four kids, and basically my entire childhood, you know, my mom was very sick and couldn't really take care of us. And my dad was unemployed many years for several reasons. And, you know, they were both unhealthy and kind of sick at some point. And so, you know, I kind of assumed the role of the parent many times. You know, I remember making, you know, help, you know, heating lunch for my siblings, sitting down, doing homework with them, helping them, you know, take a shower. And, you know, we lived in a small community. We were the poorest, you know, but by far, I was teased by my friends at school because they were donating clothes to my family. And sometimes they, you know, you go to school with a new shirt you found in a box that someone put outside your door, and apparently it belonged to your neighbor, and they tease you for it because, you know, that's what kids do.
Wow.
And
wow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought of that. I mean, you know, from your social media and your presence, you know, you're very fashionable. And so, you know, to think that you grew up that way, it's very humbling.
Yeah. I mean, we were not hungry because my parents always found ways to put, you know, food on the table. We were also, you know, around the holidays, again, people would leave boxes with food. So I can't say, you know, there were far, you know, and there are people that are actually hungry in this world. I was not hungry.
Right.
But you know, I when we were buying shoes, my parents always bought shoes that were 2-3 sizes bigger because I needed to grow into the shoe because there's no money to go and buy a shoe every 6 or 12 months. These are your shoes for 3 years. And so, you know, it shapes you. And I think you decide what to do with it. You can fall into that victim place and say, you know, I'm the poorest. Mm. We don't have money. This is terrible. Or you can say, I'm going to do whatever I can not to be in this place. It is what it is. I'm going to take care of my family and I'm going to build wealth so I don't need to buy my kids, you know, shoes that are 3 sizes bigger. And, you know, my shoes were terrible. I was a tomboy. I was running in the mud and they were always too big, too dirty, and too old. But these were my shoes and I embrace it. That's my past. I embrace it with a smile because, you know what? It makes every dollar that I make today much, much sweeter.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's how you choose to look at a certain, you know, you choose how to perceive a certain experience. It's easy to say, it's hard to do. I don't know why it was easier for me than others. Maybe it was a combination of my parents really supporting me as a child. I remember they used to say, you can do whatever you want.
Oh, that's great that they said that.
You can do. Yeah. And I believed in it. And maybe that's why you think that I'm courageous. I'm not. I've been told my entire childhood that I can do whatever I want.
That's
so I assumed that it was true. So when someone is telling me, you can't get into MIT or you're never going to be a lawyer, I said, no, I can do whatever I want, you know, and I want to be a lawyer. I want to have an MBA from MIT. And that's what I'm going to do.
That's awesome. You said the word decide. And I think that that's such a powerful thing, is that you decided that that's not going to define you. It's actually going to be, it's going to help propel you and motivate you to have a different life. Where some people in that same circumstance may decide, you know what? I'm not good enough. I'm born to this type of lifestyle and I'm just gonna, you know, do what life gives me. And so look, if there's listeners out there, I know there are, there's people that they have it in their gut. It's like being in church, like, you know, and you feel like the pastor's talking to you, like you have it in your gut that you really want to do something different, but you're afraid to do it and you're afraid to fail. But, you know, when are you going to do it? Like, you got to do it at some point. You know, you got to take a chance because that's part of living. That's part of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. The other things that came to mind about how you grew up was, you know, one, being the oldest of four children and your parents, from one reason or another, whether it's sickness or whatnot, you know, you had to shoulder more responsibility at an earlier age. So you learned responsibility and how to, you know, be responsible for not only yourself, but also your younger siblings, which is a great quality. But you didn't mention this, but I wonder if there is also a little bit of resentment that, like, you had to, you know, be put in that position, or did you not look at it that way at all?
No, Darren, there's actually zero resentment.
Awesome.
When you grew, you know, I grew up to this, that's all I knew. And that was, I assumed that was normal. And until I grew up a little bit more, and then instead of being resentful, I said, this is the situation. You know, I'll do whatever I can not to be in that position again. You know, when I'm old enough to take care of myself, because, you know, when I made that realization, I think I was about 11 years old or so. And it was, you know, I was still living with my parents. It's not that I could go out there and start, you know, buying real estate at that age.
Sure.
But yeah, no resentment.
That's great. That, you know, and it goes to your character and the way you look at things. You know, you decide, you know, so you are accountable for your own situation. And you're not making excuses, and you're not taking the victim card. So that's very consistent with everything that you said. So help us understand. Now you're in the multifamily world, and you start to raise capital. You know, where do you get most of your passive investors? How did you build the relationships? We talked about how you built relationships on the JV side. By going to conferences and whatnot. How did you build relationships with passive investors? Who typically invests with you?
So I think investors that invest with me are those who see something in me that they recognize within themselves that they can relate to. I have a lot of lawyers, for instance, because I used to be a lawyer. I have also investors that are in the tech industry because they respect, you know, my education experience in the tech industry, and because MIT is a very tech oriented school, and a lot of first or second generations of immigrants, because they relate to my story of immigrating to this country and starting something from scratch. Some of them are small business owners, some of them are, you know, have sold their companies and they've retired and they only invest passively. And I would say 95% of my investors came, you know, through my website. They read about, either listen to my podcast or listen to one of, you know, my guest appearances, like on this one, for instance, or they read my Forbes article or some content that I put out there. They go to check out my website and there's a form there. It says, if you want to invest with Ellie, leave your, you know, information here, and you can basically, you know, if you want to talk to me about investing together. That's basically how most of my investors, you know, and at some point my brand, you know, got enough attention that I started getting the big players' attention, you know, the family offices, the preferred equity groups, the big, you know, groups out there that started reaching out to me and say, hey, we want to invest with you. And I think my investors like the fact that I have those large, you know, players investing with me because they have a lot of resources. They're vetting the sponsor. They're vetting the deal. They have an entire team of underwriters that look into all of that. And some investors say, hey, you know what, if a family office is investing, I want to invest also, because I know that these guys are putting a lot of effort into, you know, vetting, you know, the deal. That's how it's been done.
That's a great point. So what do you like to do outside of business, outside of work?
I love skiing, even though now in
snow skiing COVID or era,
Yeah. Snow skiing.
Okay. So where do you go?
Actually everywhere. A little bit in Canada, Mount Tremblant, for instance. I like to ski in Reno, Nevada, in Colorado, kind of all over the place.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love skiing as well. I grew up in Connecticut, in the Northeast, but Connecticut doesn't really have any nice mountains. So we would drive up to Vermont and ski on the weekends. And then I lived in South Florida for 14 years. And when you're living in the sunshine every day, it was nice to get to Colorado or Utah in the winter and get some skiing in. Since I've been in Dallas now for 10 years and I have yet to go skiing since I've been here. I don't know why.
I need to get back in there.
I need to get back into it. So I had people when I got to Dallas say, hey, you got to go to Colorado during the summer. And we've done that several times and it's absolutely beautiful. And so, you know, Colorado has the summer beautiful weather and then the winter, the skiing. So if people want to get in touch with you, it sounds like your website is the best way to reach out to, you know, so what is your website? How can people reach you if they want to reach out to you?
So my website is just simple, ellieperlman.com. And you can also Google my name, Ellie Perlman, and you'll see, you know, links to, you know, things that I've been writing, to my website also, of course. That I would say that's the best way, you know, to reach out to me.
Fantastic. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Ellie, I really enjoyed getting to know you and I look forward to seeing you at a conference in the future. And until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.